Hi everyone, we just want to welcome you all and thank you all very much for coming. And I'd like to introduce you to Lama Marut. And Lama Marut is a professor of comparative religion and also has a lot of training in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And he comes to us as a spiritual teacher who gives us great practical ways to put the wisdom and knowledge of the spiritual traditions he knows so well into practice. So thank you all very much for coming to join us, and thank you so much, Lama Marut, for coming to teach us.
Thank you. Thanks, guys, and thanks for coming. This is the first class of four, but each one of these classes will be self-contained, so you can feel free to drop in to any of them. I think we'll probably try to review everything in each class so that each one will sort of serve as a self-contained sort of entity. This is the sort of launching of a series of courses that I'll be teaching as part of what we're calling the Middle Way Centers, of which the Heart of Wisdom here in Melbourne is one of seven. There's another one here in the computer in Singapore. And my idea is to, in my old age, to leave something behind that may or may not be useful. We'll see. Something like 20 or 25 courses on the spiritual life. And this one that we're starting with is the foundation. It's the basis for any authentic spiritual life. Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, doesn't matter, and, or nothing. You know, there are many, many people now who, when asked what your religious affiliation is, are you, you know, Christian, Jewish, Islam, or whatever, they say none of the above. And that's an increasing segment of the modern population in places like Australia and the U.S. and so forth. So you don't have to be affiliated with any particular religion to be interested in living a good life, a happy life, and a life that's led by spiritual principles instead of the kind of principles that our secular life encourages us to live by, which are, greed, consumerism, and egotism. So it's auspicious that we're starting today. I don't know if you know, but this is an international Buddhist holiday called Vesak. It's the day that they commemorate the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and passing, which are all supposed to happen on the same date. Not the same day, but the same date. And so that's kind of nice. It's the full moon. Buddha Purnima, they call it in India. Buddha Purnima. Purnima means full moon. So it's the full moon night tonight here in Melbourne. And that's the moon that marks this kind of holiday in Buddhism. So it's kind of good that we're starting this whole big enterprise on such an auspicious day. You all have handouts, I hope. They're not very detailed. They're not very long. And I'll go through the verses. The material has been taken from several different sources. So in order to emphasize and underline what I was saying before, that there are common teachings in all the world's traditions, in all the world's spiritual traditions. And so I've taken some material from the Buddhist traditions, the Theravada Buddhist tradition, the Pali scriptures. The most ancient of the Buddhist scriptures are in the language called Pali, so we'll be looking at some stuff from that. And then the Sanskrit, Mahayana Buddhist tradition, as well as the Hindu traditions, as represented in texts like the Bhagavad Gita. And then I've drawn a little bit from the Western traditions, from the Bible, also known as the Bible. So some of you may have heard of the Bible, and they've got a lot of good stuff in that text. And so we'll have a chance to sample all of it. This particular course, this is the foundation of the foundation. It is titled with you know, with four things. What's the problem? What's the cause of the problem? What's the alternative to the problem? What do I call that? The solution?
The goal.
And how do I get to that alternative? And this is a kind of a framework that encapsulates any authentic spiritual tradition. To have those four kind of headings. You know, what's the problem here? I was tempted to call it Houston, we have a problem. Remember, like when the astronauts were in that space shuttle thing, and then they realized that their spaceship didn't work anymore, and so they radioed down to Houston and said, "Houston, we have a problem. You know, our rocket ship isn't functioning." And our rocket ships aren't functioning. We all have a problem. Houston, we have a problem. So that's today's class. Actually, this class is the problem, to talk about the problem. And you know, a lot of people don't like to think about problems. You know, it's a hard sell for people who are living kind of lives that we're living to tell them that, you know, there's something that needs to be changed. Of course, until a disaster occurs, and then you don't have to convince anybody. But in between disasters, and those are the two states that we're in, either in the disaster or between the disasters. In between the disasters, we sort of, you know, kind of get this narcotic haze. And we say, you know, oh, that was a bad time back then, you know, 3 months ago when I, you know, had the divorce or lost my job or, you know, had some sickness or something like that, right? That was a bad time, but now I'm feeling better and getting back on my feet and, you know, and what's the unspoken thing? And maybe that kind of thing won't happen to me. See, maybe somehow I'll dodge every other bullet in life and just, you know, kind of live unscathed. And that's just simple-minded, okay? That's naive. So my job today is to convince us that Houston, we have a problem. And because without that, we will never work for an alternative, you see? We'll never work for a solution because we won't admit that there's a problem. If you don't admit there's a problem, then you know, why bother? Why bother to change at all? So that's today's class. That's this class. Then later this afternoon at 4 o'clock, we'll talk about the cause. And you know, one way to think about this, you know, one kind of like colloquial way to talk about the cause is to say nothing happens for no reason. Nothing happens for no reason. It's very interesting that in our sophisticated, modern, scientific, highly educated society, that we leave large spaces in the world for things that just happen for no reason. Bad luck. How come I didn't get a parking place closer to, you know, breathing space? You know, bad luck. Just happened. No reason. See? And we've got all kinds of them. All kinds of, like, areas in our lives where we don't struggle with the idea that everything is caused. We don't struggle with it, so we just lazily just say, I don't know. No reason. Bad luck. Whatever. The whatever syndrome, right? We generally don't think that things have no causes when good things happen to us. When we get a raise at the job, for example, then it's caused. Then we're big fans of causality when good things happen to us. Well, you know, I worked hard, the boss noticed, you know, I'm being rewarded, cause, effect. But when bad things happen to us, then we tend to throw it out the window and say, well, I don't know, no reason. So nothing happens for no reason, and it's not somebody else's fault. Okay, first one is like, how come I'm having problems? And the second one is, you're having problems because you created them. And it didn't happen for no reason, and it's not somebody else's fault that we're having problems. So that's later on this afternoon. Then tomorrow we'll hit the third one, which is the solution. You can think of it like this. It's not the solution, it's the goal, right? It doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. I think many people after a certain age, and I won't put a number on that. But after a certain age, just settle for low-level unhappiness in between high-level versions of it. You just settle. And say, well, that's the way it is. That's life, you know. What can I do? Just life. And we don't have to settle. It doesn't have to be this way. There's an alternative. That's a truism in any spiritual tradition. All of these are truisms in any spiritual tradition. You got a problem. You know, no spiritual tradition starts by saying everything's hunky-dory, don't worry about it, just carry on. Right? Otherwise, we wouldn't have a spiritual tradition. We'd need no need for any kind of spiritual life or training or anything like that. Okay? And the second one is, and it's not somebody else's fault, you see. No authentic spiritual tradition relieves us of our own responsibility. Every authentic spiritual tradition demands that we take responsibility for our lives in one way or another. You know, it may be like praying to some deity who's going to help you, but at least you got to pray. You know what I mean? You got to take responsibility. You got to do something. And then the third one is that it doesn't have to be this way. All authentic spiritual traditions hold out some alternative to suffering, to a life filled with problems and so forth. You're right? They have some version of a heaven or freedom or liberation or whatever you want to call it. Nirvana, you know, some version of an alternative. And then tomorrow late afternoon, the method. How to do it, you know, a method. And I call this one, you know, just like as a way to try to remember it. You can make it if you try. You remember that old Sly song, Sly Stone song? You can make it, you know. You can make it if you try, but you're going to try, of course. There is a method, and we'll talk about the method in a very general way, because there's lots of particular, you know, kinds of versions of the method, but I think they can all be summarized in what in Buddhism is called the Eightfold Path, which really is a kind of a long-playing version of the threefold path. Okay? And three gets like an accordion, gets stretched out into eight. So here's the three methods, three kinds of headings, three groupings, you could say, of any authentic spiritual method. And, you know, check me out. If you find an authentic spiritual method that doesn't have some version of one of these three, I'll go back to the drawing board. Every authentic spiritual tradition teaches ethics. Ethics. Okay? There's no amoral spiritual traditions. There's no spiritual tradition that says, oh, just do whatever you feel like. Don't worry. You know, just try to get away with as much as possible. That'll work out for you. You see? Lie, and as long as no one catches you out on it, you'll be fine. Yeah, nobody's saying that. So that's the first one. Ethics. Living an ethical life. The second one is contemplation, meditation, contemplation, some form of learning how to be alone and quiet in your mind. And that doesn't mean like physically solitary necessarily, of course, that helps sometimes. But it means how to be in control, mindful as we go through our lives, instead of mindless, instead of running around like chickens with our heads cut off. Right? Ever seen that? It's quite a phenomenon, and many of us are living such busy lives, such lives where, you know, we're just consumed all day long, 24/7 practically, with stuff to do, that we don't live very mindfully, you see. So that also is a major component in any authentic spiritual tradition, is not necessarily to go into a monastery or to head for some cave or to go into some retreat cabin somewhere, but to learn to live in this life, in our ordinary lives, in our everyday lives, in a mindful fashion so that we're in control of ourselves, basically, instead of being controlled by events, you see, and being swept away by our daily lives, to have some sense of awareness and mindfulness, okay? And then the third one is wisdom. Ethics, some kind of meditation, contemplation aspect of life. And then the third one is wisdom, understanding what's what. And so we'll go through that tomorrow afternoon. And again, I'll kind of review each one of these with each class, so that people who are just dropping in are, you know, kind of kept up. Here's another way. This is a way that a Buddhist teacher named Stephen Batchelor describes these four truths. They're called the four truths in Buddhism, actually. Sometimes they're called the four noble truths or the four Arya truths. I've translated it the four worthy truths. Worthy. Because I think hardly anyone uses the word noble anymore, except ironically. Oh, that's so noble of you, you know. But worthy. So four worthy truths about life and about a spiritual tradition. So here's how Stephen Batchelor describes them, a very interesting kind of a way. Remember the first one? What was the first one? That's today's class. No.
The problem.
Yeah, the problem. Houston, we have a problem. Rather than shying away from or ignoring what is happening, embrace it with mindful attention. That's another way of describing part one. Instead of shying away from or ignoring what is happening, embrace it with mindful attention. So don't turn your back on problems, you see. Don't try to hide or run away or put your head in the sand about the realities of life. But face them. You know, they're not going to go away by you not paying attention to them. Or trying to, close your eyes and, like little children, who they hope if they do this long enough that you won't be there when their eyes open again. Okay? It's not a spiritual practice to engage in fantasy. The beginning, middle, and end of a spiritual practice is to face reality and to learn how to live happily in reality. Not to substitute one set of fantasies for another. And many, many people don't get that when it comes to religion, They think, well, religion's just all about fantasy. Either positively, oh good, I can have some positive fantasies instead of this crappy life that I'm leading. Or negatively, when they, criticize religion as just being fantastical. Why would you believe in religion? It's all just about make-believe. And that's not a true spiritual path. A true spiritual path begins and continues and ends with the embrace of reality as it is. And reality as it is filled with problems. Okay? That's number one. So that's his first, that's the way that Stephen Batchelor describes the first worthy truth. Rather than shying away from or ignoring what is happening, embrace it with mindful attention. Then the second one. What's the second one? What was the second one? Yeah, the cause. Nothing happens for no reason. That there's a cause for suffering. And it's not your brother-in-law. It's not your boss at work. It's not the girl that you're bluing with. We'll have to translate that into other cultures. It means arguing, right? Boom. So here's how he describes the second one. Rather than craving to seize it or get rid of it, Things I like, I want to seize. Things I don't like, I want to get rid of. Rather than craving to seize it or get rid of it, relax one's grip. Relax. This is actually, I've come to believe that this is one of the most deepest and profound of all spiritual teaching worldwide. Relax already. Just relax. Because when we're not relaxed, we're not thinking straight. Relaxing is a very, very important practice. And it's one that we're increasingly it's foreign to us, how to really relax. Even when we go on holiday, we're hardly relaxed. Because, many, many people, if you're like me and people I know, on holiday, all of a sudden you've got all kinds of things to do too. You make your little list of, all the places you're going to go and the things, I got to go fishing and then I got to do this. After fishing, we'll go to the cafe and and we just organize our lives, even in holiday. So relax. Relax already. That's the second truth. The second truth is instead of grasping and craving, wanting things to be different, wanting everything to change, to relax. And to understand why things are happening. Then the third one, Batchelor describes like this. rather than getting caught up in a cascade of reactivity, a cascade of reactivity to events, stop and stay calm. That's the third truth. This is a very interesting kind of rephrasing of these three worthy truths. What was the third one? The goal. And so you're saying, like, rather than just reacting all the time, just stop. As we'll see in the Buddhist text, the goal is described as a, you know, to use a kind of a fancy English word, cessation. Cessation means stopping. The goal isn't to do something more, actually, to acquire something or attain something that you don't already have, but to stop the constant reinvention of more problems, the constant recycling of more and more problems. Just stop. It's a very interesting thing. Our ultimate default setting as human beings is happiness. Our ultimate default setting is happiness. Our penultimate default setting, you know the difference? Penultimate means almost ultimate, is suffering. Our ultimate default setting is perfect happiness. So in some texts, in some traditions, they talk about it as like we're like the clear blue sky. Do you remember clear blue sky here in Melbourne? Remember when you had a clear blue sky?
Yeah, often.
Today.
Often. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's kind of defensive about your weather here, aren't you?
A little bit.
So it's like we're like a clear blue sky. And then we turn on the cloud machine and obscure our innate fundamental happiness and goodness. And so that's what he's kind of pointing to when he says, you know, stop. The third truth is stop. If we stop, cessation, if we stop the problems, if we stop the clouds, we would be happy. So then the fourth one, and then we got to start the classroom. Rather than repeat what you have said and done 1,000 times before when it comes to problems, rather than repeat what you have said and done 1,000 times before, act in an empathetic and imaginative way. That's the fourth one. What's the fourth one?
Solution.
Yeah, the solution, the method. So rather than just do the same things over and over and over again that we've always done with no success, you know, this is a definition of insanity, to just keep trying the same thing and getting the same results over and over and over again, you know, and not changing, not thinking that you're going to get a different result the next time you try the same thing that's always brought you another result. See what I mean? Just banging your head against the wall over and over and over again. So the fourth one is change, making some change, some kind of change in your life that will work. All right, so that's kind of an overview of the four worthy truths. So today we have to start with, in this class, we have to start with the problem. So let's, if you have your hand up, please take a look. Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention. I plan to go on for an hour, 15 minutes, hour and a half at the most. Hopefully. If I keep going after an hour and a half, somebody should start, like, you know, making faces at me. Because I'd like to, number one, leave some time for questions at the end, and number two, have you do an exercise at the end of each class. So you'll see that at the end of each of the handouts, at the last page of each of the separate handouts, there's a little exercise. And, you know, I could say, well, let's all just, you know, go and have coffee on Chapel Street and you can do the exercise in between classes, or maybe you'll have time to do the exercise when you get home tonight. But if you're like me and have noticed your own behavior in the past, if you don't do it like right away, you're not going to do it at all probably. So I thought we'd leave time, 15 minutes, you know, at the end of each class to actually do the exercise. You know, and they're personal. You're not going to hand them in. I'm not going to grade them. You know, it's just for you to actually try to think about maybe putting into practice some of the stuff that we're talking about in the class. All right, here we go. This is the course is somewhat structured around this Buddhist text. This is a Pali Buddhist text. In the Pali, it's called the Dhamma Cakkappavattana Sutta. Dhamma Cakkappavattana Sutta. Sutta. When I was in graduate school, I studied Sanskrit, and I've been, you know, reading Sanskrit my whole life, and I'm just now learning Pali. I always despised Pali. All the Sanskritists in graduate school despise Pali, because Pali, we all used to like joke that Pali is a kind of vernacular that grew out of Sanskrit. It's sort of like the Romance languages growing out of Latin. Hmm? And so we all despise it, thinking like it just sounds like Sanskrit baby talk. So instead of saying sutra, as you say in Sanskrit, sutra, you say sutta, sutta. Yeah. Dhamma, dhamma, dharma in Sanskrit is dhamma, dhamma. Anyway, I'm no longer dissing Pali. It's a very interesting, you know, very beautiful language and all like that. And I've translated these verses from this sutra. This sutra purports to encapsulate the first words of the Buddha after the Buddha's enlightenment, after the Buddha's awakening. So some of you know this story, right? The Buddha was born as a prince in a very wealthy household. He had flat screen TVs and plasma TVs and two or three cars and, you know, maybe a boat and all kinds of holidays, and he certainly had very, very good coffee all the time, $4 each, lattes. Sound familiar? He had all kinds of ethnic restaurants to go to, lots of shopping there on Chapel Street to buy all kinds of stuff that you want. So very colorful socks that I see people have. And he was protected. He was his father and mother purposely protected him. They kept him in an isolated bubble to protect him from the realities of the world, because they were afraid he was going to become Buddha, basically, instead of like the successor to the crown. They wanted to keep him in the worldly life, and you know. So eventually, he realized that it was all kind of an artificial thing, that he was living in an artificial. So he left. And he tried different sort of spiritual methods. He experimented in the ancient Indian sort of spiritual marketplace, sort of like, you know, their version of what we have. You know, got all kinds of spiritual options now, right? You can be a Sufi, you know, what do you call it, whirler? Whirl dance?
Whirling
dervish. You can learn how to do that. Or you can, you know, learn Kundalini yoga and, you know, put on a turban and do that, or, you know, you become a Buddhist and say Om Mani Padme Hum, and, you know, there are all kinds of possibilities, right? So he tried a whole bunch of them, and none of them really worked, which is kind of interesting point. You got to find something that will work. You know, that's the ultimate criterion for a spiritual life, is does it work? Does it function? Does it bring you the happiness you are looking for? And the alternatives that he tried weren't working for him. So he tried the alternative. He tried the method, fundamentally the method of meditative mindfulness. That was really the method, jhana in Sanskrit. Jhana is meditation. And sat down under a tree on this date, you know, according to the Buddhist tradition, on the full moon of May, and sat down in a tree and said, I'm not getting up until I figure this damn thing out. I'm not getting up until I awaken to my true happiness, to my true nature. And he did. And then he was tempted. I don't know if you want to hear the whole story. Yes, those stories are fun, aren't they? He was tempted to just say, well, I got mine. So, you know, I'm happy. And other people are going to, they won't really get it, you know. It's going to be really hard to convince other people to do what I've done. And anybody in the room who has been a yoga teacher or a spiritual teacher knows this temptation, you know, to just like say, well, the hell with it, you know. People just don't get it. You know, you tell them the same things over and over again, and they keep coming back with the same problems because they didn't try, they didn't do anything about it. It can be very, very frustrating. I'm sure my teachers felt the same thing. You know, you just get a little discouraged sometimes. So the Buddha was like tempted to say, well, you know, it's just going to be too discouraging, too hard. And then like the story is that, all the gods come and they plead with him and say, come on, you know, for the good of all humanity, you better, you have to teach. You have to teach people what you've learned. And so, he plays sort of hard to get for a while. And I don't think so. No, I don't. And then the third time they ask him, he says, okay. And from then on, actually, in the Buddhist tradition, there is a tradition of asking for teachings three times before a teacher is actually supposed to give you a teaching. You're supposed to ask three times to make sure that you really want one. So he consents, and he goes and he finds a couple of five, I think, sort of practitioners that he used to hang out with, you know, who are practicing, a very, what they call ascetic, kind of method. Torturing themselves and not eating much, and, maybe swinging on hooks and, things like that. They see him coming. And, he had left that group. He had left that group because it wasn't working. He was so, like, weakened from not eating and things like that that he couldn't think straight. Sometimes you'll see statues like this of the Buddha in museums of when he was in that phase, and he's just like skin and bones, because he's learned to live on like one pea a day or something like that. So he comes back, and these ascetics see him coming, and they say, oh, here comes that loser, Gautama, the quitter. And look how fat he is. Look how well-fed he is. What a loser. Like that. And the story goes that the Buddha just raises his hand and says, shut up. That's a loose translation, but just shut up and listen. And then he teaches. Then he teaches the first sermon. So this text is from that first sermon. And in the first thing he says, the first thing out of his mouth after he awakens to his own potential, to his own happiness, is, you guys are in deep doo-doo. You guys who aren't me, who haven't awakened, are suffering. The word is dukkha in Pali, dukkha in Sanskrit, dukkha. And that's the usual translation, is suffering. I've tried it, and I've been teaching this for many, many years, and I've found that there's a lot of resistance, especially among people like us, to the idea that life is suffering. We know that life is suffering. I mean, suffering is a pretty strong word, We know that life is suffering when we're in the disaster. In the middle of the disaster, you don't have to convince anyone that life is suffering. If you've just lost your husband or wife, if you've just had a major tragedy in your life, you've lost your health, you know that life is suffering. But the rest of the time it's like, well, come on, it's not so bad. You should get out more. Go enjoy a show. They've got 3D movies, very realistic. Have some fun, just relax and have some fun. Life isn't suffering all the time, And there's a point to that. Well, life isn't suffering all the time in the kind of way that we usually think about that word suffering. So I've tried it like this as a new translation, okay? And who knows, maybe next week we'll try a different translation. This is the worthy truth about distress. Distress. Dukkha. Things are distressing. Things are stressful. Yeah? Then maybe it's not so hard to believe, because things are stressful. Right? And then he goes and he does a whole shopping list of all the things that are stressful. Birth is stressful. And, I thought about this a long time, too. I don't think he's really talking about mothers here who are giving birth. Although, would you say that that's kind of stressful, to give birth? He's talking about the baby. He's talking about coming out of the birth canal, which is, horrendously stressful. you know, you spent 9 months in this kind of warm, fluid womb, you know, having somebody else feed you, and, you know, however they do that with that tube thing. Dr. Yun knows, but he'll tell me later. And, you know, it's just like warm and cozy in there. And then little by little by little, as you get, you know, closer to the actual birth, you know, it gets more and more constricted. You know, you can't, like, you know, move around much. And then, when it comes time for birth, it's like, you know, there's a whole theory, actually. In traditions that have a belief in rebirth, that there have been past lives, past and future lives, that the reason that we can't remember our past lives is because we have post-traumatic stress from being born. That there's kind of this, like, such a traumatic, stressful event in just being born that it kind of wipes away all of any kind of memory that we have of what went before. It's kind of, I mean, it's just one possible explanation if there are rebirths. Anyway, birth is stressful. Birth is stressful. Second one is sickness is stressful. Anyone quibble with that? You know, when you're sick, I mean, you know, even just a little cold. We're moving into the cold and flu season. They used to talk about that in advertising, didn't they? Mm-hmm. The cold and flu season. So you get little sniffles or a sore throat or something like that. And, you know, he's not happy anymore, stressful. The only people that think that sickness isn't stressful are people who haven't been sick. And that would, I would say there's nobody in this room who hasn't had sickness, is it? This is part of life. There's nobody in this room who hasn't been born. Okay, so we all went through the trauma of birth. And then, you know, we've all lived long enough to get sick. Not probably just once, but many, many times. And then there are a whole variety. There's a whole range of being sick, too, right? Having a little cold is bad. All of a sudden, when we have a little cold, all of a sudden, have you noticed the whole world sort of shuts down? You know, we don't care about anything other than how bad we feel, you know. I don't care about you. I don't care about your problems. I have a cold. Let alone things like cancer, you know, leukemia, you know, like major, major problems. It's stressful. Sickness is stressful. And sickness is ubiquitous, happens to everyone. Then the next one he says, old age. Old age is stressful. And again, the only people who don't think so are people who aren't old. I had a lady, I gave a talk to a very small group in a beautiful yoga center in the middle of nowhere, outside of Portland. Is Portland in Victoria or South Australia?
Victoria.
Is it? Yeah, it's at the very sort of border. You know, in a very small, you know, kind of country setting. Beautiful people there, and like 30 or 40 people showed up. And I was talking about this sort of formula, you know, birth is suffering, birth is stressful. Old age is a sickness, death. And there was a very elderly woman. She was maybe in her at least 70s, probably 80s, who started a big argument with me about how awesome old age was. Old age is not suffering. And, you know, what a wonderful sort of experience she was having of her old age. To be that convinced that there was, you know, it was just great. But most of us, I think, know that when you get older, things start going wrong. And And there is a kind of a stress with that, because you miss what you used to have. You miss the vitality, the strength, the kind of, you know, body image that, you know, you used to have, and all of that when you get older. And nobody can not get older unless you tragically killed early, right? You know, if you're lucky enough, everyone will get older. That again is not like just for some people, that some people get old and you know, and start like having their faces get all wrinkly and the big sag, you know, where everything starts to like kind of, like gravity asserts itself and everything starts to fall a little bit. And that's not just for other people. And when it happens to you, it's not just you, you know. So this is one of the important things that can help us when we are confronted with stressful situations, with suffering, is to realize it's not just you. See, God didn't single you out to get old or to get sick or to, you know, get squeezed through some small birth canal. You know, we're all in the same boat. We're all equal. Nobody's getting off easy here, you know, in this kind of life. Nobody's skating. We keep hoping to find people who are just having an easy life. That's the attraction of movie stars, I think. And very famous people. So they have all this money and they have all this fame and they, you know, they vacation on, you know, Caribbean islands, and they even own islands, you know. Some of them own islands, you know. At least they're having a good life. And then we get we get kind of fascinated with the rich and famous, because we think that maybe their lives are somehow qualitatively different than ours. They don't have any suffering somehow. But then equally, we're equally fascinated when we realize that they do. When they have their divorces, and when they have their, you know, nasty, you know, fallouts, when Gina Reinhart has her big, like, you know, disputes with their children. It's like, you know, well, we can't get enough of that. We also read that, because it's kind of a perverse thing. We're simultaneously setting them up and then really happy when they fall. Both. My point is just that nobody's having an easy life. Nobody gets through life without problems. Okay? You're born, you get old, you have sickness, and then death, of course. Death is suffering. Death is stressful. And, you know, again, you know, if you don't believe that, you really haven't gone through any kind of real tragic loss of, you know, somebody very, very close to you. And I don't know that anyone in this room is that young to have never had anybody die on them. My friend started to die on me when I was 15. My best friend at the time was murdered at the age of 15. So, you know, it happens. It's happening all around you, you know? People are dying all over the place. And, you know, we just kind of like, you know, don't really think about it much until it happens to us directly, when someone, you know, very, very close to us, or when we ourselves, of course, die. We're all mortal. Anyone unclear on that? We're all mortal. We all will die, for sure, okay? No ifs, ands, or buts about it. We will definitely die. And everyone around us will die, too. Everyone in this room will be dead in 80 years. None of us will be here. And that's hard, okay? That's hard for us. Because, you know, there's some part of us that does want to live forever. I was reading a book, actually, that was talking about the whole science now of extending life and the kind of, you know, optimism that they have, that they can, you know, within a very short period of time, relatively, that they can, we can all expect lifespans of 100, 120 on a regular basis. Even now, it's kind of amazing. My father used to live in an old folks home, and you know, there were plenty of people in their 90s, you know, hanging out there. 90s, you know, it's kind of ordinary now. And so, you know, maybe in the future we'll live to 120, 140. Maybe there's no real biological need to die. You know, possibly. Like, if science can, like, figure it out, maybe. But who would want to live like that? See, who would... Would you like to be you forever? You know what I mean? So I think even if, like, you know, even if science figures out a way to keep us all biologically alive, we're not going to want that. It's kind of like, you know, much of science invents stuff that we actually don't want. I remember going, I was talking last night about going to Chicago when I was a kid, visiting there was a very cool museum there called the Museum of Science and Industry. This was 40 years ago, 35 years ago, and they had phones that you could see the other person. You know, when you're talking on the phone, you could see the other person, video phones. They've had that technology for 35, 40 years. And nobody wants it, because nobody wants to, like, have to, like, look good every time they go on the telephone. You know what I mean? Really. So, I don't know that death will ever not be. You know? biologically, maybe they can do amazing things, but we're still going to want, we're going to die, and we're going to want to die if it gets, you know, many people do, right? When it gets just too difficult to live. So those are the first four. When confronted with what's, then he has a kind of a more, even more general one. When confronted with what is disagreeable, it's stressful. When we have things that we don't like happen to us, it's stressful. And, you know, again, anyone unclear on that? Anyone never have things that they don't like happen to them? This is, again, you know, universal. It's part of being alive. It's part of being a human being that things don't always go your way, that you have problems, that things happen that you didn't want to happen, right? So when confronted with what is disagreeable, it's stressful. It's stressful to be separated from what is agreeable. When we have something that we like, when we have a relationship that we like, it's hard to have it end. It's hard to be separated from it. And there's nobody who hasn't had that experience. And who isn't having that experience on kind of an ongoing basis. Being separated from what's agreeable. I mean, you know, even at very, very simple levels of having, you know, of having your car not start. That's a separation from something agreeable. It's agreeable to have a car that starts. When it doesn't start, it's like, oh my God, I'm having such a bad day. Got to call the RACV?
Yep.
Because my car doesn't start, or when your iPod doesn't boot up, or, you know, all kinds of things. We're separated from things that we like, you know, and want to keep. So it's stressful when confronted with what is disagreeable. It's stressful to be separated from what's agreeable. And when we don't get what we want, it's stressful. Isn't it? When we don't get what we want in all kinds of ways, materially, emotionally, you know, in terms of reputation, when people don't like us, when people don't put enough thumbs up on our Facebook posting. It's stressful. It's disagreeable. It's not fun. It's not happy. In short, grasping to the five groups of mental and physical things that make up a person is stressful. This is kind of a long, involved teaching, but what he's talking about here is the five physical and mental components, main components that make us who we are. Of course, our bodies, and then the four kind of main components of our mind, our consciousnesses. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, conscious of sound, consciousness of sight, and then mental consciousness, also consciousness of what's thought. So that's one of the mental parts. The first one's the physical part, then four mental parts. Consciousness, feelings. We have basically three kinds of feelings. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Although I was never really that clear on what a neutral feeling is, but you know, it's just kind of feeling like whatever, I guess, whatever. So we have the feelings. Then what they call discrimination or perception, the ability to tell things apart, to tell people apart, to tell, you know, the chair is different from the coffee cup, etc. That function of the mind. And then the last one is what they call, in Sanskrit, samskaras. This means propensities, proclivities, habits that we carry around, and some of those can be unconscious, subconscious or unconscious. Anyway, so grasping to that as if it were me, grasping to those five kinds of components and thinking that's who I am is stressful. And one of the reasons that it is stressful is because each and every one of those components is changing all the time. And so, you know, for people who were here last night, this is a kind of an illusion, that we have a self that isn't changing because all the components of the self are changing. It's like saying that there was a flock of sheep, but there's no sheep in the flock. To say that there's an unchanging me based on all the unchanging parts of me, it is a similar kind of non sequitur. It doesn't make sense. Every part of my mind and body is changing. How can there be an unchanging me? All right, so that's the first thing the Buddha had to say. And I imagine that he got the same response from his audience as I get from mine. It's like, gosh, you know, cheer up. You know, why dwell on the negative? As if not thinking about the realities of life is a good strategy for dealing with them. Okay, so as I said earlier, we can't solve a problem until we recognize that there is a problem. And not recognizing that there's a problem is not a solution to the problem. These are not, you know, this sort of laundry list that the Buddha laid out is not for just some people, you know, sometimes. It's the state of our lives. It's the ongoing state of our lives. It's the, you know, one way to think about this list is it is the description of our unhappiness. Especially that one of, what is it, not getting what you don't want, not getting what you do want, and not being able to keep what you like. That's a kind of a general description of our lives and why we're unhappy. So that's the Buddha. And then he says at the final, he uses a very important word, grasping. The Sanskrit is upadana, grasping. And we'll come back to this later on this afternoon, because that's one way of thinking about the cause. The cause is craving and grasping, wanting, desire, and grasping. Grasping means like trying to hold on to things that are constantly changing. It's futile. It's like, what do you call it? Trying to grab feathers or something like that. They just kind of like always are ungrabbable. It's like grabbing air, you know. And our grasping to things that are changing as if they weren't changing is one way of talking about the cause of our unhappiness. Trying to arrest change. Or trying to direct change in the way that you want it to go. Either one of those enterprises are totally futile and causes all kinds of problems. Trying to stop change means trying to grasp onto a relationship or to a financial situation or, you know, to whatever it is, to a house, as if it were never going to change, as if the roof was never going to leak, as if the relationship would never change. This is, especially with relationships, this is a cause of much, much, much distress. Dukkha. You know, of saying to your partner, you know, you've changed. Well, the partner, well, of course I've changed. How could I not change? How could I stop? You know that Billy Joel song, "Don't Go Changing," blah, 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 blah. "I love you just the way you are," you know. But nobody's not changing. You can't stop change. You can't stop yourself from changing, and you can't stop other people from changing, and you can't stop the relationship between people from changing and growing and evolving in different ways, or devolving, depending on how the relationship's going. Okay? So grasping on to changing things as if they weren't changing, or the other one of trying to micromanage change and like sort of like channel it in the directions that you find, you know, like desirable. That also, have you noticed that doesn't really work that well, right? Can't just change, you know, like I was talking about last night, you know, with the "I Dream a Genie" shaking your ponytail. You know, trying to magically change the present and the present according to your will is futile. Doesn't work. Can't work like that. So grasping, and we'll come back to it. That's a very important concept. The next verse is from a Mahayana Buddhist scripture, a Sanskrit Buddhist scripture, called "The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life." This is, this one especially is what I would call it, desert island worthy text. Like if you only had one book to take on a desert island, you know, to read, "The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life" is one stop shopping. Got it all. And so I really like the text, and I've taken this verse from it. "Today there may be health, enjoyment, and no problems." No worries, mate. Today. Yeah. No dramas, no worries. "Today there may be health, enjoyment, and no problems, but life is fleeting. Life is changing. And deceptive, he says here. The Sanskrit is very interesting. Visamvadi means breaking your word. It means like not delivering the promise. And life is like that. Because we set life up. We think, well, you know, I should have X, Y, or Z in life. This, my life should be X, Y, or Z like this. And life doesn't always deliver, does it? Doesn't always like live up to its promise. So it's deceptive. It's very similar for those of you who studied Buddhism to the word they use in later in the guide, samvritti. Samvritti means hidden or deceptive. They talk about samvritti, satya, deceptive reality, and ultimate reality, deceptive reality, and ultimate reality. So this is a kind of a word that indicates that the world is not what it seems to us to be. And pointing to the fact that we need some wisdom, you know, about sort of looking beneath the mere appearances, the mere surface levels of life, to get at how life is really working. So we'll talk more about that, I think, probably tomorrow. Today there may be health, enjoyment, and no problems, but life is fleeting and deceptive, and the body is just on loan. So this is another source of our problem, is attachment to the body. And and if you don't think that you're attached to your body, we can all do a little experiment, you know, after class, and dangle you by your heels from the balcony here onto Chapel Street and see if you're not attached to your body. You know? I've heard this in a number of different spiritual circles, you know, people who get all like kind of airy-fairy and goody-two-shoes and, oh, you know, I'm not really identified with my body that much. You know, oh, come on. We'll try that experiment with anybody who says that, okay? Put you in front of a train as it's coming right at you and see, like, if you move from the track, you know? You're very attached to the body. You could argue that it's among at least the top three or four or five attachments that we have in life. We have a strong, strong attachment to our body. And that causes us all kinds of problems, of course. Number one, because the body gets older. You know, it changes. It gets older and it gets sick. It doesn't always stay healthy. And then we go, well, how could this have happened? I got old. You know, I got 60, I got 70. How did this happen? Well, what did you think? Right? And the answer to what you think, what did you think, is I thought I'd never get old, actually. As totally unrealistic as that is, we kind of grasp onto this kind of illusion that we'll always be young forever. Young people, beware. Because you got it. You've got this illusion that somehow you'll always feel the way you do now physically, that you'll always look the way you are look now physically. And then you change, you get older. Or you have, you know, disease, you have sickness, you have accidents, maybe a big scar on your face. You know, bodies change, right? Bodies are constantly changing. And then the big disappointment is the body totally lets you down at the end. And that's called death. Right? This thing, this body that for years you've been like combing its hair and, you know, you've got, maybe you grow your beard and then you've got to trim your beard all the time and, you know, shave, you know, just here. You know, and put on your deodorant and your perfume and you buy new clothes for it and, you know, you exercise it, you take it to the gym or to the yoga studio and, you know, you work out and you look at it in the mirror and, oh, I'm looking better these days. You know, this body that we just pamper, you know, and sleep, we gotta sleep, I gotta rest my body. My body got tired, I gotta rest, I gotta feed it all the time, I gotta brush its teeth, you know. How much time and energy do we spend on our bodies during our lives? Only to have them completely let us down at the end. Completely. Okay? Deceptive, right? They didn't live up to their bargain. They didn't live up to the promise. Made a deal with the body. I'll brush your teeth. I'll comb your hair. I'll take you to the yoga studio. And then you let me down completely. The body deal completely let me down at the end, right? So this is a major source of suffering, identification with the body. So then, you know, we'll come back to the solution, you know, later. But for now, I mean, you know, are you your body? Is that all you are? Are you just your body? Identification with the body as if it were your whole being, as if it were your whole self, is a little bit of a losing proposition. That's kind of designed to make you suffer. It's guaranteed 100% or your money back to make you unhappy if you're fully identified with your body. And none of us isn't at least sometimes fully identified with the body. We all do this. If I ask you, how old are you? If you give me a number back, that means you fully identify with the body. That's me. I am 60 years old, you see. That means I am my body. So it's not only going to do this, but it's guaranteed to cause problems, you see. Guaranteed. Next verse. Happiness is up to you. This is a very, very pessimistic verse, okay? It's from the same text, the Guide to the Bodhisattva, we write. Happiness is obtained only occasionally and with difficulty, while suffering occurs regularly and without effort. And, you know, we can laugh and giggle about it a little bit, but it's kind of true. So I said before that our ultimate default position is pure happiness, true happiness, ultimate. But our penultimate default position is suffering, is stress, distress. I translated here dukkha as suffering just because I forgot to translate it the other way, as distress, but you can change it if you like. Our penultimate default setting is there's always something wrong. Let's just check, shall we? We'll do at any given time, like even now, you can just stop and say, is there anything wrong with my body? And there's always something wrong with your body. If it's not something big, and hopefully nobody has any big problems with their body here, there's always some little aches and pains, right? Some little cuts, little nicks, little scabs, little pimples. You know, there's always something physically wrong, isn't there? Always something little wrong. You got a little, you know, ache and pain here, you know, whatever. Always something, right? What about mentally? Always something wrong. Always some kind of like unhappiness. Here's mostly what it, you know, in general, how you can describe the unhappiness that we almost always feel. I wish I were somewhere else at a different time. I wish I weren't here and now. Always thinking about, well, what's going to happen afterwards? He's going on pretty long. He said he was only going to go on for an hour. What am I? I need a latte. I haven't had a latte for at least 2 hours now. Right? Always thinking ahead, or sometimes, you know, we're spacing out about what already happened. You know, oh, what did she say to me last week? I'm really going to get back at her. You know, obsessing about the past. Obsessing about the past or projecting about the future. And wishing that you were in a different place in a different time. Almost always. Check and see. Just at any given moment, just like observe your own mind and notice that you're not happy here and now. Happy here and now means content with where you are and what you're doing now, here, in this studio, in this particular moment in time. And that's a very rare occurrence, actually, for almost all of us. We realize retrospectively that we have been happy when we were fully here and now. You know, when we were completely grabbed, our attention was completely grabbed by the footy game, or by the, you know, the novel that we were reading, or by the 3D movie that we were watching. And then we thought, and that's what makes the footy game good. That's what makes the movie good, is that we aren't self-consciously sitting around going, when's the movie going to be over? When's the footy going to be over? See? We're not there in a way. The self-consciousness is gone. And we're fully present. We're fully in the here and now. But anytime that little voice is working, that little, you know, the little inner voice, anyone not have one of those? Be good to get rid of that someday. But that little inner voice that is constantly chattering in there is almost always, I would say always, okay, I'll just like explore it, is always saying something other than how awesome it is to be here and now. Because if it was truly awesome to be here and now, that voice wouldn't be talking at all. You see what I mean? We would have, and we do have experiences. Those are the experiences in which we are actually happy. And that's why people, you know, kind of are attracted to them. That's why we pay the money for the 3D movie. That's why we go to the flea. That's why we hope that this novel will be, you know, satisfying like the last one we read or whatever, right? That's the whole attraction of sexual intercourse, of course, is that you're not there. If you are there, it's kind of like not such a good, you know, experience, right? If you're sitting around, like, narrating what's going on, it means it's not such a pleasant experience for you, see? It's not the experience that you hope for. It's very interesting, isn't it? That's a very, very telling a kind of observation about what real happiness is. Real happiness is the loss of self. It's the loss of the self-consciousness. It's when the inner voice shuts up and we can finally live. See, it's not going to some fantasy land with a sort of a better inner voice. You know, oh, look at the rides here, or look at the unicorns, or look at the rainbows. Or, you know, it's not a fantasy. It's not to substitute one fantasy for another. That's not real happiness. Real happiness is losing yourself in life. See? Is being, I would call it like this, mindfully unself-conscious. Mindfully unself-conscious. So it's not just spacing out. Spacing out is a little bit of a relief. But the true peak experiences, the true experiences that bring us ultimate happiness, we're mindful, we're engaged. You see? It's not like we're mindless, we're not spaced out. We're engaged. But we're unself-consciously engaged, right? I know there's a bunch of guys in the room who are into sports. I think this happens not just watching sports, but playing sports, is that you lose yourself in the game. You see, you're not sitting around going, well, should I, you know, tackle this guy? You just do it, right? You just kind of like are in the game. And that's a very interesting experience. Everyone's had some version of this. It's called play. Play is the opportunity where we can be engaged mindfully, but not self-consciously. The self-consciousness comes when we think about who's going to win. So the difference between play and games, right? The self-consciousness comes like, well, you know, if I did this strategy and it's all the strategizing and then I'll win and somebody else will lose. All of that, it's the play that brings us the joy, not the game. It's the play because we have no self-consciousness about it. We're not thinking about it. We're just doing. We're just enjoying. We're just living, see. And that's the goal. That's the goal of a spiritual life. Not to go into some fantasy land and live on a cloud and play a harp, but to learn how to live happily in our own lives on a moment-to-moment basis and be fully engaged. Okay. So how did I get off on that?
You were on that verse and about being happy here and now instead of in a different region.
That's it. So we're always kind of low-level unhappiness. When we're self-conscious, we're always unhappy. How's that? When the voice is still yabbering in there, we're always dissatisfied. That's what that voice is saying. That's the whole language of that voice, is the language of dissatisfaction. All right, so anyway, he says, but it's only because of suffering that there's renunciation. So here's the good news. Here's the silver lining about distress, about problems, about recognizing problems. If we didn't have problems to recognize, we would never want to change. The renunciation means renouncing, giving up unhappiness, constant distress, constant suffering, constant dissatisfaction. And if we didn't have dissatisfaction, how could we want it? How could we give it up? You see, how could we change? So it's not that we don't have dissatisfaction, but the recognition of the dissatisfaction is the precondition for change, for wanting to do something about it. So you know, a real sort of strong, healthy-minded practitioner would say, yeah, great, I'm having problems. Great. Now I know what I need to fix. You see? While I might obtain many things and enjoy happiness for a long time, when I leave this life, it will be empty-handed and naked, as if stripped bare. And this is kind of an important thing to also recognize. The mortality, okay? Back to the mortality issue, okay? Don't worry, every class won't be like this all weekend long. But you gotta confront it. You gotta like recognize it if you're gonna change it. If you're gonna do something about it, you gotta recognize it. And mortality is something that not recognizing is not doing us any good. It's just not. We're wasting large, large parts of our lives because we think we'll somehow live forever. And then we defer things, we postpone things. We say things to our loved ones that will, you know, the awful, awful, hurtful things because we think, well, later on I'll fix it, you know. Well, one day you won't fix it. One day you won't have any more opportunities to fix anything. And that day, so this is hardcore, this is a hardcore meditation that really we should all be doing on a daily basis. Not necessarily in some, you know, yogic posture with your eyes closed, but just in a kind of a, you know, informal way to remember every day that you will die. For sure. Use the first person pronoun. I will die. Not other people die or there is death or something like that. I will die. And I don't know when I will die. Anybody want to quibble with that? Anyone want to like, is that controversial in some way? So no, but I work out. I eat right. I eat yogurt. And so, you know, and so I should live at least to be 85 or 90, like he was saying. Maybe 110 by the time I get old, maybe the biologist will, you know, kind of extended life. You know, like we all think this, don't we? And there's no guarantee. I don't care how much yogurt you eat or how many downward-facing dogs you do. The truck doesn't care either that smacks you on, you know, on Punt Road. See, you know, accidents happen. Yeah, and this is just the case, okay? This is just the facts, okay? This is reality. Sorry, no more fantasy. This is reality. Reality is death is for real, and the time of death is totally unknowable for any one of us. Totally unknowable. And then the third part of this is called death awareness. On a pretty much daily basis, a good thing to do in the first thing in the morning, before you get out of bed, is to just remember what you know. Today could be the last day I have to live. I have no guarantees that it won't. Today could be the last one. So how am I going to... So the third one is, so what am I going to do with the rest of my life? See, I don't know how much time I've got, but so what am I going to do with it and stop wasting it? It's a very, very powerful meditation. Very, very powerful. And none of it is unrealistic, is it? None of it's fantasy. None of it's like spiritual, you know, hobblins and goblins and, you know, things that go bump in the night. It's just reality. I will die. I don't know when I'm going to die. And so what should I do with the time that I have left? Very powerful. Very, very powerful. How many arguments are you going to get into today if it's your last day to live? You know, how many big arguments about, like, who took my parking place or, you know, where's the paper cutter at work? Who took my stapler? You know, I think you took my stapler. You know, all this is kind of at that level, most of the arguments that we have with other people. Just totally meaningless when set in its proper context of the finite nature of our lives. Every moment that we live is one less that we have to live. And there's only a certain number of them, and we don't know how many there are. All right, so anyway, that... the non-recognition of mortality is a major cause of suffering. Major cause of suffering. Because it, you know, we're always postponing. We make mountains out of anthills because we don't recognize the finite nature of our lives. All right, here's from the Bible, okay, and then we'll do our little exercise. Do not, this is from Jesus, from the Gospels, Matthew and Mark. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, and where moth and rust consume. You know, the moths eat it, and the rust rusts it. And where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasures in heaven. You know, heaven means like, what's going to last? What's going to be permanent? What's going to make a difference? What you can keep instead of the things that you can't keep. And what you can keep is the changes that you make in your mind, in your life. You can keep those. They go with you. They go with you all the way to death and probably further. Who knows? Store up here for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust consumes and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. We do what we think is important enough to do in life. So in a way you could say we're defined by the choices that we make in life. If we choose to just be consumers and hedonists and so forth, that's because we thought that that's the most important thing to do, and therefore that's who I am. And so he's saying, like, you know, you've got a choice. He makes it quite clear at the end here. No one can serve two masters. You know this verse? This is a very famous one. No one can serve two masters. For a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. Then he says, you cannot serve God and wealth. The word is mammon. You know, I learned it as mammon. You can't serve God and mammon. And I was very confused for many, many years. Now, who the hell's mammon, you know? I think they told me who God was, but who's this mammon guy? Mammon is shopping. Mammon is consuming all the time. Mammon is just money and what money can buy. And he said, you can't serve two masters like that. So think about your future. You see, how many of the things that you know that you spend so much time working for and desiring and thinking about, obsessing about, how many of those things are going to last? No, and the answer is none. Okay, and you can't take them with you. Have you heard that expression? Can't take it with you. There was a bumper sticker I used to see in the U.S. quite a bit. The one with the most toys at the end wins. And that's the kind of whole summation of consumer capitalist ideology. That's the whole point of an ideology that's just based on consumption and buying and greed. It's just buy as much as you have as much fun as you can, and the one who has the most toys at the end that they can't take with them wins somehow. So the suffering, you see, the suffering helps us get clear on what's important in life. Our unhappiness can be very, very useful because it can lead us to what will really make us happy and away from the stuff that's constantly making us unhappy. The constant, you know, dissatisfaction, the constant greed, the constant buying, the constant need for ego enhancement and all that, these are not ways to make you. They just make you more unhappy. They're a source of suffering. So that's just a little overview, okay? Just as a kind of a summation, and then maybe we'll take some questions and do the exercise. The real problem, we're coming to the cause of the problem. The real suffering is grasping, as we said, grasping. And especially grasping to me, to the self. So you can, there's all kinds of words. I've been writing a book, you know, about this. And so I've been looking up in the thesaurus. There's so many words that have self as the beginning of a hyphenated word. Self-interest, self-concern. So, you know, like that. Self-cherishing. self-aggrandizement. You know what aggrandizement means? Just more, more, more. Bigger, bigger. Ego enhancement. Self-consciousness, like we were talking about before. It's very interesting that there are many, many words that indicate that the problem is S-E-L-F. That's the problem. And so the solution is going to, I'll just tip you off, is going to be to learn how to be less self-conscious, less self-aggrandizing, less ego-enhancing, less about me, me, me all the time, you know? That's the inner voice, actually. The inner voice is reciting a mantra. You know what a mantra is? Words of power that you recite over and over again. Here's the words of power, the mantra that we're all reciting over and over again. What about me? What about me? What about me? Am I okay? Am I going to get a break here pretty soon? Am I going to get a latte? What about me? Right? And on the way to having the little voice shut up altogether and just live, not narrating life, not mediating life, but actually living life, is to improve that voice. So right now the voice is the whiny me voice. And the spiritual life is meant to improve that voice so that you start to hear a different soundtrack, a different inner soundtrack. And here's how that one would go. I'm okay. What about you? I'm fine. I'm okay. What about, what can I do for someone else? So as long as you're not okay, as long as you're not fine, the record, the loop, what do you call it? The loop that just keeps playing over and over again. What about me? What about me? Over and over and over again. Because I'm not okay. I don't feel okay. So the point is to learn to live a life where you can be okay and start thinking about someone else and what you can do for them. And then the ultimate goal, I would say, is to just do it. Not to like talk about doing it, even in your mind. What can I do for them? I'm okay. But to just be doing. Just be living. In a kind of an unself-mindful, unself-conscious way in which you are part of the solution instead of part of the problem in life. In every situation in life. And that's the goal. Take a few questions and then maybe we'll do our exercise. I'll talk about the exercise in a minute. But if there are questions. Chuck, do you have any questions from Singapore? You get first shot. Okay, thanks, Chuck. This is your chance. Doesn't have to be about anything I said either. But no mathematics or...
I think I'm contemplating what you're saying. The idea of the self in European languages and European people have this sense of definition. Mm. I get this feeling that the Buddhist ideal is to blow all that away and to negate the vehicle or the sense of not so much individuality but separateness in the negative sense. But now the question is, what is the self in the positive sense? Is there a self that's big enough to contain all other selves, or is there a self that's worthy as an individual?
The self is, of course, it's limited biologically. I mean, when I hit my hand, you don't feel pain. So there is a sort of a biological, physical separation between us. But that's the separation of physical bodies. And so that's what I was talking about before, of one of the main causes of our suffering is the complete identification with our physicality. And that entails separateness from others. That's it's kind of a defining feature of our separateness from others. So the stretching out of the sense of self can't be quite physical. It has to be mental, right? And it's kind of interesting because, also as I was saying before, it is our strongest wish to extend our sense of self. It is a very powerful wish. That's why we have families. That's why we have friends. That's why we join clubs. That's why we, you know, identify with nation states. I'm an Australian. You know, because we don't want to be separate. Some part of us doesn't want to be separate. And so we almost naturally, mentally at least, you know, stretch out the borders of self and identity quite naturally, quite easily. You know, when something happens to my kid, it's like it happened to me, right?
Yeah.
So it's not something foreign to us. It's not something that we have to, like, kind of invent out of thin air. But
if you take the Socratic idea, mm-hmm. you know thyself, Socrates is obviously talking about something else, surely.
Well, that's something, like I said last night, it's a million-dollar question. Who are we talking about when we talk about ourselves? It's a very complex question. Let me try to, like, move it to a different level. You know, I was talking a little bit before about the end of self-consciousness when we have these kinds of peak experiences. Sometimes psychologists nowadays call it the flow, getting into the flow, where you kind of lose yourself in an activity, especially an activity that's a little bit challenging for you, so that you know there's a challenge for it. Who are we then?
That's a definite loss of definition.
Yeah. You know, but it's not that we just become nothing. But so I'll put it like this. This is the language I'm working on in this, you know, book I'm trying to write. Who are we when we're not being somebody? When we're not, you know, kind of self-consciously identifying ourselves as a conception of the self? You know, who are we then? And, you know, just to play with the language a little bit, you're nobody. You've entered into the great nobodiness. And that doesn't mean nothingness. It's not that you're nothing. But you're nobody, and therefore you're the same as everybody. Because everybody's nobody. Okay? Yeah. Everybody is equally nobody. And then we create our little somebody individualities and separate ourselves out and become, you know, kind of unique little snowflakes. But every wave comes from the same ocean. And that's the ultimate self. The ultimate self is the ocean, not the particular wave that you're, you know, that you think you are now. It's just a passing thing. You know, waves, they rise, they last for a while, and then they go away. But the ocean stays the same. And the ocean and the waves aren't different. There could not be a wave without an ocean. Right? Right?
Yes, I mean, it's kind of a llama, isn't it? Ocean.
Yeah, well, it's a common image, actually. There's a number of them, you know. We are in many ways nothing other than the name that we give ourselves. Name and concept. But there has to be silence for there to be a name. There has to be silence for there to be a sound. Sound emerges from silence, right? And we emerge from the great silence. And we will go back to the great silence. And when we're not somebody, we visit the silence. We have a little visiting time with our true nature, with ultimate reality, with who we really are. And that is the happiest times of our lives. That's when we're truly happy. And that changes us. That has a kind of a dialectical kind of a relationship with the somebody. The nobody and the somebody are in relationship. So the times that we visit our nobody self makes us feel like a better somebody when we return to our somebody self. See what I mean? That's a big topic.
But I think a lot of people these days, particularly here in the city, identify with sport and just running. Even people who kind of so-called can't run, you know, they have a bit of a jog, and they get into another zone.
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah.
extension of weather.
Yeah, and I think you know, I think that the real goal is to get into the zone but not be zoned out. To live life mindfully but unselfconscious. And that's tricky. It's a little tricky. I mean, we're pretty good at being zoned out, and we love being zoned out, actually. That's the whole big appeal of, you know, drugs and alcohol and all kinds of things. So you can just, like, lose that, have that voice shut up already. See, we're driving ourselves crazy. So we do any all kinds of things to anesthetize that voice. So we want that. But we have to learn how to be mindful while we're in that zone also. Not just mindless. Not just be mindlessly zoning out, but mindfully in the zone. Yeah. To be in the flow, but not being carried away by the current. Like that. All right, let me ask you to do your exercise, okay? And, you know, by the way, I'd like feedback. You know, this is a first time I've taught this course, to, you know, kind of want to create a curriculum. So if you have any suggestions about what would be work better for these exercises, let me know. If you turn on turn your page to exercise number one. Chuck, did you get the handout? Did we send you the handout by email? No? So we can send it to you at the break, maybe. Do you have it here on that computer?
Well, I'll see if I have.
Okay, anyway.
I sent an email.
Okay, we'll send it to you in just a minute. Use the space below, so you see that there is blank space there. That's where your writing goes. Use the space below to make a list of things in your life that cause you stress and anxiety. Include the obvious ones, difficulties at work, with personal relationships, self-esteem problems, money issues, but also the anxieties that revolve around fear of loss. Losing the things and people you value, your health, look, youth, looks, etc. Okay, so just please spend, 5-10 minutes doing that. So you can kind of identify, where's the suffering in your life? Where's the distress? I sort of forgot to say that, you know, in the Buddhist enunciation, you know, Buddhism sort of specializes in suffering. There's sort of three kinds. There's what they call obvious suffering, the suffering that you have when you're having a tragedy, when you're having a disaster. It's obvious. But then there's the second one called the suffering of change. The suffering that comes from the fact that we can't hold on to things, that things just kind of are passing through our lives. And then the third one is, you know, the suffering that's endemic to having, you know, kind of a physical body like this and a mind like this. Kind of like, you know, it comes with a package. Inevitable that there'll be problems with your body and mind because of the nature of the body and mind. Anyway, do a personal thing here, okay? On your own suffering.